This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Inner Space, Altered Realities in Speculative Fiction.
So this week we thought we'd blow your minds. which is going to be quite difficult because I think it's fair to say, Jules, that both of us are actually quite tired.
I know. It's almost like we've been working and writing and doing stuff all year and suddenly it's almost December.
I know. My brain is not firing on all cylinders. I'm not going to lie. But hopefully we'll be coherent enough this episode for you guys to understand what we're trying to talk about.
If we don't blow your mind, maybe we'll just really confuse you. But you'll get one or the other.
You can't pick or choose. just if we do confuse you, you must assume that it's because we were so brilliant that we couldn't follow. And not that we were so inept that there was nothing to follow. Please assume the best of us.
Yeah.
Okay. So, reality. What is reality? What's reality to you, Jules?
That's actually quite a tough question, isn't it?
I mean, yes.
Because reality for anyone is slightly different. And that it's a bit like the colour purple, isn't it? Nobody sees it exactly the same way. So, but you do have to have some shared idea of what reality is, otherwise everybody's functioning on different levels and nothing would get done, and then, you know, people would have different value systems, and you can see how this would all turn into like complete anarchy.
Yes. So we have to have a sort of a collective or shared truth, which is interesting because it's a collective and shared truth that goes beyond sort of morality and goes beyond religion and everything like that. It's so much more fundamental. And I think probably most of our understanding of what reality is probably adheres to Descartes. Hey, I've got a joke for you, Jules.
Okay.
Okay. So, Descartes walks into a bar. The barman says, "Beer?" Descartes responds, "I think not," and promptly disappears.
Okay, that's pretty good.
You're welcome. For those who don't know a lot about Descartes, he has the famous doctrine of "I think, therefore I am," which is the whole, you know, concept at the time, that the big argument about what reality was. Sort of boiled down to Descartes, so it's René Descartes, who came up with cogito ergo sum, that the only thing that one can be sure of truly existing is oneself, and the only way we can know that is because you can think. If we can think, therefore we must exist. But that's the limit of it. That's the only reality that we can actually truly confirm exists. Everything else, it can be under question.
I'm not going to please a great number of people, I think.
No, but, yeah. No. it isn't.
Broadly, yes, you could certainly, and obviously you did, make an argument based on this.
Yes. it didn't please a lot of people, as you say. People weren't raving about it. I mean, they were raving about it to a certain degree, because obviously I think, therefore I am is still a saying which a lot of us will recognize and know. So, you know, there was enough of a commotion about it that people nowadays will still recognize it. But, the concept that the value of existence, the only thing that we can confirm as being real is our own conscious minds, not even our bodies. That's the thing. It's not even our bodies. We cannot confirm that our bodies are real. The only thing we can confirm exists is our conscious mind.
I mean, he was onto something in the sense, because the brain itself is a modelling system and it takes its information from our five senses.
Yeah.
And you can feed the same information into different brains. Please don't take that literally, because that's kind of gross. If I assume there's a person involved as well. But you can have several different people and give them the same information via their five senses, and one person, if you gave them wood, rectangular, and a, you know, length of a person, one person would come up with a table and someone else would come up with a coffin. And a lot of it depends on outside influences on the brain itself as to how things are perceived. So.
Exactly. And that it is the interesting thing. And I was actually talking about this with my class about when it was about, we were talking about reading texts. We have great discussions. I'll never tell you whether I'm being sarcastic or not. No, I'm not. They're great discussions. They're very interesting. And my class love them. That bit I'm being sarcastic about. but I think they're really, really interesting. And we were talking about the fact that every time everyone reads a text, obviously, we'll all read it differently. And that's for the same reason that we see the world differently. We interact with the world differently, very simply because of the way of who we are and the experiences we've had, which will taint the way we see things. If you've seen, it's the ability, for instance, and that this is where the imagination comes into it. So I can say unicorn, okay?
Yep.
I can say unicorn. Presumably, you've never seen a real life unicorn.
If I had, I wouldn't admit it on air.
Yeah. Good response, Jules.
Yes, I thought
so. Okay, I could say unicorn. Let me even try something completely different. What about a moon corn?
Well, my brain's gone to a funny place.
moon corn. Let me tell you about the moon corn. So the moon corn is sort of gold, silver in colour. Very sleek, short fur that shimmers. It has an arched, long back and looks something, and looks like a very, very large horse with very, very large hooves, which are golden in colour. Okay?
Okay.
And it has two horns, which are both sort of crescent in shape.
Okay.
Okay, so can you picture it?
I can now you said that, yep.
Good. All right. I just made that up. You won't have ever seen any images of it because I just made it up. It doesn't exist, once again, because I just made it up, and yet you are able to picture it.
Yep.
And that's simply because I gave you a list of things of which you do have experience. So I say the word horse, you know what a horse is. You go, aha, a horse. I know what a horse looks like. So you went to the horse jar in your brain and went, horse, and you plucked out horse. And then I said, but with bigger hooves. And you said, right, you concentrated on the hooves. You then went to the big jar and said, what does big mean? Big means extended in size. So you did that. And basically all of the information that I gave you, you just plucked out from the different sort of informationary jars in your head, and were able to create something. Now, if you'd never seen a horse before or had no idea what a horse was, that would have been a much more difficult task, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. You would then have to have described what a horse was in order to...
Exactly. So this is a moment, that's a very simplified way of saying that our experiences and what we know and what we've seen will change the way that we understand things.
Yeah, definitely. And to bake your noodle even further, if we look at physics terms, no information that comes into your brain via one of your five senses, or your sixth sense if you have one, none of it is ever untainted.
Yes.
So, if you are familiar with the Copenhagen theory of observation, whereby the act of observation changes that which is observed,
mm-hmm.
This obviously led to the thought experiment, which people know as Schrodinger's cat, which we won't go into. I really like it as a thought experiment, but it's not really relevant to this. But the whole idea of the Copenhagen theory is that basically, if you were to look at a rock, now
observe the rock.
Observe the rock. Observe the rock. Be one with the rock. Feel the stag. Sorry, I went off on a tangent there. Observe the rock. The reason you can observe the rock is because you're looking at it presumably with your eyes. The reason you can see it with your eyes is because light is reflecting off the rock to your eyes.
Yes.
Contrary to what certain students I have tutored in physics in the past have believed, your eyes don't send light to the object. It's actually the other way around.
I'm sorry, wait, what?
Yeah.
What kind of crazy sci-fi eyes do these people have, Jules?
I don't know. I mean, I said it was a really neat idea, but that's not really how it works. Light itself is an eigenvector, thereby you never really see the rock in this case. My brain's now gone to Dwayne Johnson. You never see the rock in its natural state. You never see it uninterfered without an eigenvector, because the most basic eigenvector is obviously light.
Yeah.
And light shining on something actually physically changes the object. So even just the act of looking at something has already changed the characteristic of it on a physics level. That's before you even get to all the weird, wordy shit your brain does.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a potted explanation, and I can be a bit more eloquent, but I won't, because we're not really talking about physics.
But I mean, yeah, well, it does come into it. And if we go even further from physics, yeah, I bet you're all very excited. and we sort of come into sort of the philosophical side of things as well. It's the question of proof and evidence. What evidence do we have that the world around us exists? And the evidence is, I say, how do you know that that table in front of you exists? How do you know that the contraption via which you are listening to this podcast even exists, and you'll tap it and feel it and maybe taste it, I don't know, whatever you guys do, and you'll say it exists, I'm holding it, I'm touching it, I'm hearing it. It obviously exists. To which my reply is that people who hallucinate can also feel like they're holding, they're touching, they're tasting, things like that. I've tasted stuff in dreams before.
Oh god, so hi.
Yeah.
You wake up and it's still in your mouth.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's even points where you know, when you have memories so vivid that you can practically taste it.
Yeah.
You know, and we can hear things in our brain. That doesn't mean that they're out there or that they're real. No. Our exact sense of reality comes from our senses, which is all part of the brain. Therefore, we go back to I think, therefore I am. Yes. Everything is just thought and reality. And I think that this scares us, rightfully so.
I think when you then add that together, the idea that, you know, perhaps it's a collection of brains, a collection of people thinking, you have to all buy into what is effectively a shared collection of truth.
Yeah.
Which is whereby you would say, okay, well, you've kind of got the same modelling system in your head as I have, and you've kind of got the same interface with your hands and your sense of touch, your olfactory system, your eyes, etc. So we're going to agree that they're within the ballpark.
Yeah. Even though we don't know that we see the same colour or that...
In fact, I'm absolutely certain that I don't see the same colours exactly like some people do. And there's two points here. One is that I know for a fact that I've got an extra cone in my eye. So I'm tetrachromatic. Which
what?
Means that I see certain colours slightly different, which
that's
is cool, which
so
is cool,
cool,
but it's also really bad because it will feed into the whole migraine thing, so I get really vivid migraines.
Oh, that's less cool.
That's not quite so much fun.
That's not cool at all.
I don't know, I think it's like 20% of people are tetrachromatic, they just happen to have the extra cone.
Mm.
It's really bizarre. The only thing that's got more cones is like a mantis shrimp, and if you've ever seen one of those, they're like really, really brightly coloured.
Yeah.
They're even more brightly coloured to each other. Because obviously they can see more colours.
They must think the whole world is so drab.
Yeah, well, it probably is compared to them. The other interesting thing is that our perception of colour, within our brains, our perception of colour and our understanding of language develops at the same time. So when we're sort of like 2, 3, that's when that part of your brain is starting to really open up. And what's really funny is that we might, you know, we've got things that we'd say green, but we might mean you know, this sort of shade of pine green might mean spring green, it might mean moss green or jade or whatever.
Yeah.
So we have little qualifier words. There are places that there are African tribes, for example, who don't use abstracts for green. They use a different word for every single shade of green. And they're very, very precise about it. And these shades are so minutely different that we as Westerners have difficulty picking out different shades, but they can see them brilliantly. And yet they have difficulty distinguishing between something like blue and purple because they just, their brains have not developed to distinguish those colours because those colours aren't around them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was also that at one point, and this seems inconceivable to us, but, there was a time where the sea was called wine coloured. Yeah, red and blue and black were all kind of the same colour. Like, that's insane! They are obviously not the same colour, but...
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because, okay, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot here. Obviously, people say ginger when they mean like red hair. They don't really mean red hair, because it's not red as in scarlet or crimson, generally, not unless you've done something to it. What they mean is orange, but we didn't have a word for orange until we actually had the physical fruit, the orange.
Yes.
So they used the word red right up until the 1600s, 1700s, which is why you say redhead now, which is great, because, you know, I wouldn't want to be called an orange head, let's be honest.
No.
But it lingers in things like language, like Irish, you have two different words for red, and one is the red that's, you have more than that, but one is the red that's used for, you know, animal fur colour, like Madre Rua is a red dog, which is a fox.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another word for red, which just means the colour red, which isn't applied to living things.
Oh.
So it's really interesting how intrinsically colour and language are actually linked, and it seems to be across the board in all the different languages all throughout history.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
There you go.
Perceptions of reality. So that's before we even get into sci-fi, which is where we're going next.
Yes. Now, our fears about what reality is have allowed us to create some mind-bogglingly scary, very unnerving sci-fi. And I think if we go back to some of the old kind of sci-fi, we see that a lot. There's one in particular, and for the life of me, I cannot remember its name, where humans have created a reality which sort of a computer generated reality where they can go into it and all of the people within that reality are obviously that they're just computer generated. And there's this great scene where you see two of the characters walking around talking, and what happens is that the people around them move, but the people in the background freeze.
Yeah.
And only start moving when you get close to them.
I don't remember what it's called, but I think I vaguely know the film you're talking about.
Yeah. It was incredibly unnerving and very powerful. But it's amazing because it really opened up that question of what is life and what is consciousness? Because I think the big twist at the end, whether I never actually saw the end, but I'm so far from what I understand, the big twist at the end is that the character who is creating this other, who sort of is part of the operation of this other reality, realizes that actually he's just part of another reality. He's not even real.
Yeah, that sort of harks. See, you're saying this as if this is old sci-fi, and to you, it is old sci-fi because it predates your birth, but this is the sort of thing I grew up with. The stuff that really sort of raises the hair on the back of my neck is the reruns of a lot of the 60s and 70s sci-fi, which is squicky as hell when you watch it now. Mm-hmm. It really is. Special effects were in their infancy. But some of the concepts were terrifying. And it's the same sort of idea, particularly with the 70s. You've obviously heard the term 70s beige, presumably. I mean, yeah. It's in pretty much every bathroom that hasn't been renovated for like 40 or 50 years, so you're bound to have come across it. But it, sometimes looking back at some of the films and things that were produced during that era, particularly in the UK, when we were still, we'd not long come off rationing, for example, and we were still like heavily depressed, debt-wise. We were probably depressed anyway, but you know. There was this really strong, it feels like if you look back on that decade, there's that feeling, and it creeps into everything, that sense of almost ennui, but the idea that you shouldn't hope too much, that everything that we were promised has been taken away kind of thing. It's not going to get better. The only thing you can do is protest against it, or you can join the system. And that really feeds into a lot of the sci-fi of the time. And I remember watching a lot of those sort of things with my dad, and it's kind of like, this is terrible. This is really terrifying. You get to the end and it's supposedly a happy ending because the good guys won, but the good guys realise there's no point to him having won. You know?
Yeah.
And then the film ends and you're just like, right, okay.
This is so harrowing.
I'm just going to go and do some colouring now. If you're a small child. In fact, you might do some colouring now anyway if you watched it. Make yourself feel better with crayons.
Can confirm, very therapeutic.
Yeah, definitely. But going back to the title of this episode, I don't know if you've seen the film Inner Space. It came out in 1987, and my grandmother took me to see it at the cinema when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is way before Madeline was born. It's a very silly film for a naval aviation officer who's a bit down on his luck, and mm-hmm. he gets a chance to pilot a particular type of craft in a miniaturization experiment, and he is supposed to be like really made microscopic along with his little ship and get injected into a rabbit, and then the lab gets broken into, someone tries to steal the technology, and he accidentally gets injected into somebody's arse instead, and you know, hilarity ensues because he's there in his little ship going around in the bloodstream. Weirdly, what I liked about the film as a small child was the fact that you were seeing, you know, the anatomy of someone from the inside, albeit in, you know, pretty bad special effects at the time. The special effects were, you know, when you're seven, the special effects were cool. But yep. You wouldn't watch them nowadays. But once again, that's a case of very deliberately stepping away from one reality and into another. And if that feels like I'm reaching a bit, I just want people to consider that, that everything has its own Umwelt, which is the term used for basically cognitive biology and behavioural biology, where I can't remember the name of the German scientist who came up with it now. It will come back to me. But basically, it's the idea that it does no good to quantify intelligence in animals when you try and hold them all to the same standard. So, for example, you could give a monkey an intelligence test that involves opening a jar. If you gave the same intelligence test to an elephant, or perhaps to something like a crow, it's not going to do very well because they don't, you know, don't have hands. It's not actually a lack of intelligence. And you need to, in order to quantify intelligence in animals, what you need to do is be able to see it from their perspective.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we wouldn't think about, or most humans wouldn't think about, picking up things with our noses, for example. So in a test with an elephant, whereby you had to pick up something with your nose and, you know, sort it out as to whether it's poisonous or whether you can eat it or whether you put it in your mouth or your nose, you know, we'd fail quite badly, so we would be considered unintelligent.
Yeah.
If you're following me. So what I'm saying is, we're back to that sense of reality being a perception. And reality for an elephant is a completely different thing to reality for a fish or to a person, to a human. To a dog, to a flea, to something very, very small and microscopic.
Yes.
If we ever find out bacteria can think, then that's a whole new set of Umwelt, you know? Umwelt just basically means a creature's selfish world, an underworld.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've gone off on a tangent on cognitive biology there, so I do apologise. but once again, that's what Inner Space made me think about, is the fact that it is actually a completely different reality because you've taken something that's one size and made it so small it can go inside something else. and it's completely changed that person's umwelt so that they can perceive something from a bacterial level. It wasn't that great a film. It's just that's
it. You mean sure after all of that? It was...
No. I mean, to be honest, if it had slightly better special effects, I would say go and watch it because, you know, it's moderately entertaining and it will have all the irritating things that you find in 80s films in it because, you know, it was made in the 80s.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's literally a physical sort of shift in reality. But there are mental shifts in reality as well, and I think they're even more terrifying, in my opinion.
Mm. So what's the most terrifying one that you've seen?
Weirdly, I'm going to go to a book, and it's a weird sci-fi with fairies.
Ha ha ha!
And steampunk and lots of weird sex type stuff. It's called The Iron Dragon's Daughter by Michael Swanwick.
Okay.
And it takes the whole idea of changelings being taken by the fairies. And the fairies are actually sort of live in this alternate reality to humans. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, it's not a different planet. It's not a different world. It's literally just, if you could, you know how in Stranger Things there's the flip side?
The upside down, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a little bit like that, but not quite as straightforward. It's not definitely a mirror. And they live in this weird sort of steampunkish type reality whereby the fairies are undergoing almost an industrial revolution because they're at war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But they need humans because humans can touch iron. They steal them. And they have these creatures that are, you know, semi-sentient that bond with their pilots called iron dragons, and they are quite literally iron dragons. And the pilot gets into basically the cockpit of the dragon and you know, literally bonds to it through their own veins. You need iron in your blood in order to bond the iron dragon and fly it. So there are all these stolen humans that are bonded to these dragon things that are used in wars against from one set of fairies to another. And there's lots of other weird stuff going on, but I don't need to go into that. Read the book, it's really interesting. What's really disturbing is that when humans are stolen, and spoiler alert, they're not physically stolen. What's taken is their essence as humans, so a sort of etheric physical presence and their minds. But their bodies are left behind, and they're just suddenly not there anymore, and most of them end up in mental institutes. And you only find this out really towards the end when the main character escapes back and finds herself waking up periodically in this mental hospital.
Oh.
And it's this really disturbing tilt of reality as to which one's real, which one isn't.
Yeah. There was something similar in, well, not really similar, but it's about the dream world and sort of the reality. Again, you know, we talked about hallucinations and how our reality is based on what we experience and what we sense and what we see. To the point that, you know, it's even said that people can die in their sleep from dreams.
Yeah.
And there is a particular arc in Teen Wolf where one of the characters, Styles, starts to have real trouble sleeping. Or rather, he starts to have trouble in that he's having these dreams and he's never sure when he's awake or not. And it's actually quite well done, and it's really quite terrifying. Because there's this whole one scene where he's talking with his best friend Scott at school after he'd had a terrible nightmare, and he said, you know, that this is the problem, at the end of the worst part of it is that I don't actually know when I'm awake, when I'm asleep, when I'm awake or when I'm asleep. And then next second he snaps awake, sits up in bed screaming.
Yeah.
Because that whole bit that we've just watched, which was so normal, was just him dreaming. And he's terrified because he can't figure out which one is reality and which one isn't. And the lines start to blur, basically, between what is real and what isn't, and where he is. And it was very well done, to the point where even we were questioning it.
Yeah.
And then a similar kind of thing was done with... I was about to call it Centurion. It's not called Centurion. It's called the Legion.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was really mind-bendy. And I do love a good mind-bendy program. I really do. I think it works actually better in films than it does in books in some ways.
Yeah, but that first episode, I hated it. I was so angry with the whole throughout the whole episode because I did not understand what was going on. I didn't understand what was real and what wasn't. And my partner really had to convince me to keep watching. I'm glad he did, but he basically, you know, he said, look, this allows you to understand how he feels. You know, he thinks he's crazy. I'm like, yeah, I think I'm crazy after watching that. I don't want to watch this stuff anymore. I have so many questions. Because I had no idea what was going on, but I did like the way it was put together. Because again, it really did give you that sense of what reality was for him. To the point where you didn't know what you were whether what you were seeing was a dream or it wasn't. And I thought that that was really quite clever.
Yeah, I mean, I really thought it was clever. It made me uncomfortable on a personal level because I've mentioned before about the fact my temporal lobe misfires.
Mm-hmm.
And when your temporal lobe misfires, basically it alters your perception of reality, or rather it alters your perception of the shared collective of truths of reality.
Yeah.
And you see some quite weird stuff, and it's really difficult to work out what you can trust and what you can't of what's being told to your brain by your senses. And then to add to that, the entire thing doesn't let you sleep. You think you sleep, but actually what you're getting is about sort of 12 to 15 second bursts before your temporal lobe fires and wakes you up again. So you're going on permanent, really bad sleep deprivation, added to the fact that there's all sorts of weird chemicals in your brain making you see stuff that, you know, might or might not be there, or making you see it slightly differently. That's even worse.
Mm.
And it just completely takes away any sense of control that you can trust what your senses are telling you. It's quite scary shit. So yeah. I was sat there thinking, I really feel for this guy. I don't have a monster living in my head that I know of, but I really feel for this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it was very well done. And I think we just don't like to have reality questioned. So I have a comforting... I'm going to talk to you about Barclay, the philosopher Barclay, not the the chain. The bank chain. No, I'm talking about George Barclay, who was an Anglican bishop. He was Irish, and he has one of the best philosophical concepts that I've ever heard of, and to me it's perfect, because it's one of the ones that you can't actually poke holes in. Pretty much every philosophical argument you can poke holes in. And this one feels, when I think of it, as perfectly spherical. It's just complete. That's it. You either take it or you leave it. But you can't really destroy it. It's a perfect concept. And I'm sure that some of our listeners here will now get in touch with me and saying, actually, but as far as I'm concerned, it was the cleanest and most lovely philosophical concept that I'd ever seen. Now, his idea of reality was comes along from the sort of the general idea that people said, look, the physical world and we can't ever prove that the physical world exists, so we are just so the way we perceive the physical world is it's external to us, or it comes in with just ideas in our heads. But then someone said, if the physical world is only ideas in our heads, then how do we have a shared collective idea? And why is it that when one person hallucinates, another person can't see it? So Barclay comes swooping in and says, I have an answer. And the answer is that God exists. And the answer is that God created us and we are all just ideas in God's mind. So we're all ideas. And because we're all ideas, within his mind, we can interact with each other as ideas. Because we're ideas within him. And that's our shared reality. All of the ideas that he has is the shared reality that we have. However, we are created, this is sort of me ad-libbing here, I don't know whether Barclay actually said this, But we are created in God's image, which means that we are capable of creating ourselves and having ideas of our own. Which means that when we personally have ideas or, you know, hallucinations or create worlds and things like that, they are not part of the shared reality because they're not God's ideas, they're our ideas. And the reason I like this theory so much is because basically it is that God is a writer. And I just like the idea that whether I should or not is a question for another day, moralistically. But the idea that when we create something, it is real. It's not part of the shared reality within external to us, but it is part of a shared reality within our ideas themselves. Which means I come up with Rufus, I come up with Zachary, I come up with Jonathan, and they all actually exist within one another, within the same world, and they have a shared reality within that world.
Yeah, and in many ways that makes a lot of sense for me too. What I would love to hear actually is a non-writer's perspective on this, because you're right, it does feed directly into that sort of sense of being a writer or artist, creator type thing, doesn't it? Because
yeah,
it just fits really well with that.
Yeah,
it would explain why you kill off a character, and you genuinely grieve if you care about that character as well.
Exactly.
You know it needs to happen, but that's the state I'm in at the moment, so obviously that's hit a bit close to home.
You deserve this pain.
I deserve
you
the pain.
You deserve this pain. On a side note, Jules sent me her book, and it's just me screaming solidly for about 68 hours while I read it, getting back to me. Yeah, it was really good.
Yes. It hurts me too, is all I will say. It hurts me too.
But
there's an interesting book called Living with a Wild God by Barbara Ehrenreich. And it's actually basically part of an autobiographical series, but she talks about her own experiences. She's a non-believer who was brought up by quite a Christian father and mother. And yet she's, you know, it's this sense that there is something, there is a mind, there is this great collective consciousness out there. It's not necessarily very well intentioned towards us, but it's there. And you can sort of put yourself in a state where you can connect with it. And yet she describes herself as an atheist. I can't do justice to her ideas and the way she expressed them in this podcast, but I would suggest people check out the book if you're interested in Barclay and if you're interested in that perception of things. It's really, really interesting.
I might actually have to check that out. That is interesting.
I think this is all part of the thing where I think you can see a shifted reality, like if it's physical, because if you've got any imagination at all, you can probably imagine what a flea's bum belt is like, or, you know, the dog's bum belt is like. You'll anthropomorphize a bit, which isn't necessarily a bad thing,
no.
But because you've never lived that experience, you can't absolutely know, but with a bit of imagination, you can physically put yourself in that situation. Mentally shifting realities is probably why it's a lot more scary in a way, because everything you know could just get flipped upside down. I mean, this is largely what Lewis Carroll was doing with Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship with, to be honest. I mean, a lot of it's philosophical stuff, and it's been reimagined so many times by so many people who've just ditched the philosophy and just gone straight in with all the mad nonsense type.
Yeah.
And, to be honest, the nonsense doesn't hold up if you don't add the philosophy, in my opinion. But, as a side note, interestingly enough, Lewis Carroll quite probably had temporal lobe epilepsy as well. So I recognise a lot of the, I don't necessarily recognise sort of like talking mushrooms and talking caterpillars and things like that, but that same sort of flavour, that same feeling, I'm kind of sitting there reading it as a child thinking, yeah, this is really familiar.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's very disturbing.
No. I'm thinking how much of a problem it would be if mushrooms talk to you.
It would be a real problem for me because mushrooms are delicious.
I know, that's what I was just thinking. You're just there like, oh, hello, Jules, put your... Ah! As you burn them, as you put them into the pan on the high heat, you listen to their screams.
I'd end up becoming like that evil one-eyed god in the Belgariad who's just like, well, I don't really want to be a mass murderer, but you're so tasty, I've just got to keep eating you. Into the wok with you.
Yep.
I wouldn't even try to resist. That's the kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd have some trouble. So that's good. I want to talk about another sort of version of altered reality, which isn't actually sci-fi or anything like that. And that is The Truman Show.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. And that's interesting because it's a reality enforced on somebody by an outside agency.
Yeah. And, you know, you might initially argue and say, but what are you talking about? He is actually within, you know, he does exist within his own reality, you know, within our reality. But it isn't. It isn't our reality because everything is staged. His ideas, his entire life has been staged with only him not knowing what's going on.
Yeah, it's the absolute ultimate worst gaslighting experiment ever.
Yeah.
It's really, really bad. For those who don't understand the term gaslighting, it comes from a film with Ingrid Bergman, whereby she plays a young woman who's an heiress, and her husband is trying to trick her out of her fortune by making her think she's gone mad, and he does it by altering the gaslights. That's the very potted version of it. But it's now in modern vernacular, and it comes up in a lot of relationship-type stuff, whereby you've got one person basically denying the other person their right to their own truth. And it sounds like it's a really obvious thing and an easy thing to avoid, but actually it's quite difficult. Because the minute you've got any sort of emotional involvement, and I think this is kind of where they went with the Truman Show to a certain extent, when there's emotional involvement, then it becomes really difficult to hang on to your own personal truth, what your senses are telling you, when someone continually tells you that they're wrong, or that your perceptions are wrong. Because we are naturally wired to want to please the people we care about.
Yes. What's more is that if you have spent a very large time being told, oh, you have a bad memory. Yeah. Don't you remember I did tell you this? Don't you remember? And then other people say, yeah, they told you that. Okay. Especially if it comes from a figure of authority or a figure who you have been socially told to trust. So a parent, a guardian, a husband, things like that, you know. If they are telling you this information, you're much more likely to actually believe them than to believe that they're purposefully trying to manipulate and to trick you.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not a conscious attempt to manipulate. Sometimes it, you know, they're barely registering that's what they're doing. It's just that their sense that their truth and their reality is more than yours, that they need to keep control, is more overpowering than the idea that perhaps there's two points to this particular, you know, two points of view. But there are people who deliberately do it, and it's extremely nasty and really difficult to catch.
Yes, it is. And it's very difficult then to sort of be able to identify if you yourself have been on the receiving end.
Yeah, it really can be. I think that's why, I know the Truman Show is supposed to be funny, I think that's why I found it just disturbing.
The thing with the Truman Show is that the amount of people who I've heard say, all right, but am I actually in the Truman Show? Where the cameras are going to come out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think we've all had that moment, that thought of, oh God, what if I was in the Truman Show?
Yeah, well, the whole candid camera thing, isn't it? It's like, okay, life's just got really weird, somebody's got to be filming this, it can't be real.
Yeah, exactly. It is terrifying, the idea that everything you know could be a lie. Regardless of the fact that, yeah, the table might be real, but what if the table wasn't real? What if you went up to the table one day and you realised it was just a cardboard cutout?
Yeah, Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because your senses can be fooled, your brain can be fooled, and then you get back to the whole, I think, therefore I am. Well, yeah, maybe you do, but what if everything you think is wrong?
Yeah. The only thing you can be sure of is the fact that you are conscious. That is the only bit of truth that you can think. That I am, that I exist, because yeah, I'm thinking. That's the only thing I know for sure.
Well, I suppose the thing is, if enough things get proved to you as being wrong or false or incorrect or skewed somehow, mm-hmm. perhaps then it wouldn't be very difficult to erode that core belief that you actually exist.
Yep. And now we're getting into the true depths.
Yeah.
We're running out of time, so I felt like it's probably prudent if we mentioned The Matrix.
We should mention that. We should also mention Ready Player One, since that's coming out soon too.
Okay, alright. Well, let's start with The Matrix. I really liked the first one.
Yeah, I did. And it's so disturbing. Once again, it's that sort of, what if reality isn't what you think it is, kind of thing.
Yeah. And the idea of the computer program, because I did think The Matrix was great. You know, it was an excellent movie, which took a lot of the key successful parts of sci-fi that had predated it, and brought it into something more modern. And this idea of a created reality, you know, it's a step further from The Truman Show.
Yeah.
And the thing I particularly liked about it was the fact they said, well, why didn't they create a paradise?
Yeah.
And it was that it wouldn't function because we just weren't wired. We were wired to struggle. So we just couldn't function within a paradise.
And the thing is, that's actually true. A bit of research on that. We are as likely to just stop functioning and get depressed if everything becomes too easy.
Yeah.
As we are if everything becomes so difficult. We need something to strive for, otherwise we just do not function as either individuals or as a species. It's really interesting that they tapped into that.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. I do like that reality involves struggle.
The thing is, though, you can kind of, obviously you've got that one guy who just desperately wants to be put back into the Matrix and ends up screwing them all over.
Yeah.
Which is bad. We're not supposed to be rooting for that guy.
No, but I do understand him.
You kind of understand it, don't you? Because it's like, what if you really got on the outside? Oh, we're free. Well, that's great. You're free to eat sloth and live in a real dive and go around in your ship and be hunted for the rest of your life and possibly hungry. You know? It's like, you're free to really suffer. That's what you're free to do. But you're free.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is that they're free. But, like, on what level?
And it's just, how desperately would you want to know the absolute and fundamental truth, if there really was one, in order to do that? Because when you're in the Matrix, you kind of, like, you don't know that you're enslaved. You don't know that you're being used as a battery.
No, and to be honest, what happens is that you just, you never have to know. You never have to suffer that knowledge. You just die when you're done.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, there is something very abhorrent about the idea of literally just being an energy slave, as it were. But it does beg the question of, if you don't know that you're not free, then are you actually, are you actually enslaved? Are you actually imprisoned?
Is a slave still a slave if they don't know they're a slave?
Yeah.
To which Doctor Who replies, yes.
Yes, yeah, I mean, obviously you are. It's just, I don't know.
Can you confirm, still a slave.
I think I'd want to know, and then I'd probably be really bitter about knowing. I don't think I'd go back.
Yeah. And it is, it's a hard one, but yeah, it's difficult and scary, very scary. And it's making me uncomfortable just thinking about it now.
Yeah, I think all the best sci-fi that deals with this sort of alternate reality type thing should make you uncomfortable and shouldn't leave you with any ready answers. generally.
Yeah, this is why I don't read or watch sci-fi.
You don't know what
Let
you're
me just have my reality.
Ending on a slightly higher note, Ready Player One is coming out in film form soon. It's been out in book form for quite some time. It's a good book, and certainly if you grew up in the 80s, there's lots of little bits of nostalgia in there for you. What's interesting to me about this in an alternate reality sense is it's set in a dystopian future whereby, you know, it's sort of like the future dystopian 70s beige, ultimately. people live in shipping crates. There's not a lot of food and stuff to go around. But tech is really good, as in you can basically plug yourself in, and it's like the internet, but there's all sorts of games. You can be whatever character you like. You build an avatar for yourself, and it feels real when you're in there. And the whole premise of the book is that in order to win this billionaire's wealth, you have to find a certain number of things within this sort of quest scenario. And it takes years for it all to come to fruition. I mean, read the book for the storyline, because it's brilliant. But I just really liked the idea of this alternate reality where people are choosing it because the actual reality is really depressing.
Yeah.
But you have to come out of there. Otherwise, basically, you can eat and sleep and have sex and whatever within this alternate computerized reality. But you still do have to come out sometimes. Otherwise, your brain starts to overload.
I like that idea. I want that.
But it's a much more cheerful outlet, ultimately. It's not like The Matrix.
No. But I think, you know, virtual reality is the future of how that's going to work, you know.
I have to admit that as much as I enjoyed Ready Player One, I'm actually really very wary about the whole thing. I feel like I'd be signing up to be gaslit, ultimately, and I'm not sure I'm keen on that. So we'll see.
I guess we will. So what do you guys think? What is reality? What's your favourite dystopian and, not dystopian, sci-fi or dystopian? And do you agree with me that George Berkeley's idea God is a writer. Well, he didn't say God is a writer. I'm saying God is a writer. God is a DJ is what George Berkeley said. He didn't say that either. He was born in like 14 something. So it's what? Sorry, 1685. So he did not say that God is a DJ. But that was the kind of general consensus. So do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you think? And therefore, are you? Thanks for listening, guys. And we'll catch you next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.